Okay, everyone, welcome to this session. I'm Kara Swisher. I run a site called All Things Digital, which is a news and information site. We're located in Silicon Valley. And I'm here to introduce someone who I'm very excited to interview, actually. I get asked to interview a lot of people. I do interview a lot of people all the time. And the minute they asked me to do this one, I was very happy to do so. Drew, as you'll find, is a really self-possessed and classy guy. I interviewed a lot. I know a lot of entrepreneurs. I meet them all the time, and many of them I don't like so much. This one I happen to. That's a kind way of saying it. But I really like Drew a lot. That doesn't mean I'm not going to be a little hard on him, give him some good questions, and we learn a little bit about him and what he's been doing and how he's expecting to go forward with Dropbox. So without further ado, Drew Houston. How are you doing? Have a seat, please, in my living room. All right. Oh, here. Why don't you sit over there? Great. I heard they softened up the crowd with T-shirts, correct?
That's right.
Oh, you're an easy group. Anyway, we were talking backstage. We were talking a little bit about Drew's background. And I wanted to do a lot of research on Drew for this interview because one of the things that's important, his name, by the way, is not Houston, as in Texans, but Houston, correct? And so it got me in the mode of thinking the word how. And so it boiled down, because I'm a crack journalist, to two questions that I think are critical. How the hell did you get here? And how the fuck are you going to stay here? Which is really, I think, the key questions, correct? And they're both good stories, I think. Hopefully good stories. So let's talk about you want to do the first?
The first.
Okay, all right. So let's talk about your background. A little bit about your parents and how you got started on your road to geekery, essentially.
Yeah. We're going way back.
Way back.
So I grew up outside of Boston, and my first computer was a PC Junior. And mm-hmm. My parents have like pictures of me like pressing buttons on the keyboard even before I could.
Sort of like
read.
Justin Bieber, but a nerd. Okay.
That's exactly how I think about it.
Okay, good. Good. So your father was an electrical engineer.
Yeah.
He went to Harvard.
Yeah.
Did that get you into the area, or you just were naturally born that way?
Yeah, my dad, he bought that computer, and he studied electrical engineering. He's an engineer. And I just sort of naturally gravitated toward it. So
right.
Any interest I had in math and science is probably from my dad.
Mm-hmm.
My mom is a studio art and English major, and she's a high school librarian now.
Right. So she wanted you. Now she wanted you to. One of the interviews you gave, you said she wanted you to be normal.
Yes.
What did that mean exactly?
It means occasionally she would like take away the keyboard,
right.
And like kick us outside, and I'd have to like dig around with ants or like go talk to other kids or something. So.
Right. So did it work?
I think so. I mean I'm really glad that she. I mean, some kids get like pushed to like advance all the, to skip grades and all these other things. So I'm glad that she really pushed for some balance.
From balance. And yet you didn't have it because at 14 or so you started doing companies, correct?
Yeah, so that was my first kind of startup gig was I was beta testing this online game.
Mm-hmm.
And the developers were taking forever to make progress. And so I was bored and I started poking around under the hood to see how the game worked. And I found all these security problems. And complained to the developers about them, and they're like, "Oh, great! I mean, thanks for the heads up. We want to hire you as our network engineer."
And this is at 14.
Yeah, at 14. And so I'm like, "This is pretty sweet." And I did it, and then I had to fill out all the paperwork, and I'm like, I'm on ICQ chat. This was really like back in the day. And I'm chatting with the CEO of the company. I'm like, by the way, my mom or my dad is going to have to sign the paperwork because I'm only 14. And he's like, whatever. And so, that
so
was
now
like,
you're like in Doogie Howserville kind of thing, right?
From Justin Bieber to Doogie Howser,
okay.
Something in between.
Right. So you worked at this company and then continued to do startups,
yeah.
Correct? Because Dropbox is your sixth startup.
Yes, the sixth.
What are you like 17 now, right? Something like that. No, no. So you're 29 right now, correct?
So,
but it's your sixth company, which is
yes.
Amazing. So what are some of the companies you did? Were they in high school or before?
Yeah, then that was in like junior high, and then in high school. I worked for one local startup that did some kind of more mechanical engineering stuff, but I did a lot of like crazy like Linux device driver stuff. But, you know, it was a small group of people just trying to get stuff done, and it was like my introduction to the world of startups.
So why did you want to do working before that? Because a lot of kids don't do that. We were talking backstage, sort of, that some things you're born with, some things you're not. What do you think was in your DNA that made you like that?
Well, I mean, as far as being interested, I just was sort of naturally drawn to computers and you know, and probably the reason for getting started in startups was it paid a lot better than babysitting. Okay. The first thing. So that was my beginning in my career, was $3 an hour, you know, try to go over to the neighbor's house, watch their kids and eat the Pringles and, you know, watch HBO. And you know, this was a little bit more rewarding.
A little more rewarding. Okay. So you go right away from Boston, you go to MIT.
Yeah. And
your dad had gone to Harvard. Why did you pick MIT?
So my dad told me when I was looking at schools, like, you know, he was an electrical engineering major at Harvard, and he's like, there are only like four engineers at Harvard, and everybody would like ask him like, why did you come to Harvard to study engineering? And I mean, obviously they have a lot of engineering students there, but that's not really what people think about. And so he encouraged me he steered me towards MIT.
Right, and you went there 4 years, or you went longer?
I took a year off in the middle, and then I graduated a semester early.
Right, So one of the things you were talking about also was the idea of the difficulty of school being there and sort of the intensity of coding. You've given a lot of interviews, talked about sort of, you had this sort of frat group there, although you don't often think of MIT and frats at the same time. There is a whole frat system. How did you it's very intense there to go there. What was the year off about?
So the year off was, I decided to, in 2004, I saw this opportunity where the SAT was changing. And so, and there were no good, like, online courses for it. So that was, I decided to take a year off and work both, I worked during the day at a network security startup. And then I also started moonlighting on this online SAT company with a former teacher of mine from my high school. And so, I wanted to do that because it was great, because then I came back. I decided to come back to school, but it just gave me a lot more perspective on, you know, what is actually, you know, important as far as what you need to learn in school. Because what happened was all these kids would burn out because they just do nothing but problem sets and study, you know, the same things for, you know, over and over again. But there's also this rat race where it's like everybody's competing to get those like last tenth of a point in their GPA, but you go in the real world and that like just doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Compared to being able to communicate well or all these other things. And
right.
So it was really a great experience.
So you took this year off to do this, to do another startup and to get world experience and stuff like that. Why did you go back? There's many well-known Boston people, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg among them, that didn't go back. What gave you the impetus to go back?
I mean, I promised my parents that I would go back, and but sort of more practically, you know, I think in those cases, usually those people drop out, not because they want to drop out of school, but because it's just their company is taking off to such a degree that it's a necessity. And so my company is only just barely getting started, so there wasn't really a need for me to, like, immediately drop out.
So. Right, so you started Dropbox. Now, yeah. Every single company in Silicon Valley has a creation myth. You know, they're always cute. The Pez dispensers at eBay.
Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg not having a date, essentially making him a billionaire. Most of them are not really quite accurate. Let's talk. There's one of you on the bus.
Yeah.
And you suddenly had this fantastic idea. Really? Is that correct?
The first lines of code were actually written in Boston South Station. Yeah. So the way Dropbox got started was. I was working on the SAT prep company, and the kind of non-PR version of the story, the sort of fleshed out version, is I had this 3 gigabyte Linux virtual machine image, which basically means, you know, it's this really big file that I had to, and I was kind of leashed to this USB drive that I was, and then I would always be like running around and, you know, pull this thing out of my pocket, and I'd find like the connector was bent 45 degrees, and this is like, you know, this is like my company's like crown jewels on this little piece of, you know, metal and plastic, and I almost kept putting it through the washing machine and all these other things, and so this was kind of the last straw when I don't know if any of you have had the pleasure of being in Boston and taking what's called the Chinatown bus to New York, which has two distinctions. One is it's like $10, and the other is sometimes it flips over. So
that would be bad for your company.
Yeah. Yeah. So fortunately, the latter didn't happen. But I did forget my thumb drive, and it drove me nuts that, why had nobody really solved this problem? You know, why am I emailing? You know, and we, as we would later tell investors, we're like, look, you know, Tom Cruise in Minority Report is not like logging into his Gmail to pick up the attachment he sent himself that morning, right? Or like carrying around a thumb drive.
No, he's doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
So. And acting badly at the same time, which is really hard.
And jumping on couches.
Jumping on couches, yeah. So, which you did not do in this bus, correct? Because it would have flipped over and then you would be dead and that would be a tragedy and you wouldn't be here. So you you were doing this thing on the bus. You did the first lines of code. This is an area that lots of people have tried. So it's not a new area. Very similar to Google did search when there was already search. Why did you think this was promising? Just because you couldn't find solutions?
Well, I tried all the other stuff that was out there. Because back, every kind of era has its like startup cliche. Like 2006, 2007, it's like online storage startups or cloud storage is kind of a cliche. But the problem was none of these things really worked the way I wanted. You know, you'd have like one thing to back your stuff, back up your files. You'd have another thing to like upload your files to a website and share them. You'd have another thing to sync files between your computers, and it's just crazy because you'd have to use five different apps that I thought were all kind of under the same umbrella, and so it was just personally frustrating. You'd look in the support forums for some of these things because you're like, okay, well, I'm shopping for something that's going to like basically take care of all the stuff I care about.
Right.
And you'd go in the support forums and, you would read these, you'd sort of browse around, you'd read these stories of people like, hey guys, I put in all my Excel spreadsheets and then they disappeared. You know, like, what's up with that? And then some poor support rep would be like, oh, we'll get right on it. Can you please, like, upload this log file from this folder? And you'd watch this sort of thread devolve where, nothing would happen. The person's freaking out. Someone else chimes in. They're like, oh, yeah, I lost all my wedding photos using this piece of shit. And, and there's, like, invariably, it turns out the engineering is really hard on this, right, on this problem. And so I was personally frustrated that I felt like nobody had really done a good job on the engineering and all the stuff that's under the hood.
The engineering part of it.
Yeah.
That it looked good. Some of these were
and the
promising.
Experience.
There were a lot of promisings and not a lot of delivering, essentially.
Right.
So you're on this bus. You do some lines of code.
Yeah.
I'll give it to you if you want to say that. Okay, so you did some. And then what happened? What did you do then? Because you were working on this other thing. How did you decide amongst and between what you were going to do?
It was... So I'd been working on the SAT prep thing for maybe, three or four years at that point. And unfortunately, my co-founder at the time was not really in a position to, like, quit his day job and, like, for both of us to work on this full time. And it was kind of an epiphany for me, too, because it's like, I love the SAT as much as any, hormonally balanced person can.
Which is to say not at all.
But I was like, even if all of our dreams come true and it's like the best possible case scenario, it's like, okay, I'm like king of SAT prep.
Right. Wow.
And I imagine this little like crown or something.
Dates every day of the week, but go ahead.
It just, after a while I just decided, it was sort of a big turning point for me because I'm like, here I have spent years when you divide the amount of, the company was like mildly profitable and things like that. But when you divide the number of like hours I had sunk into this thing and over the income, it's like I would have been better like sewing shoes or something.
Like, or babysitting, perhaps.
Yeah,
something like that. So what made you change it? Because a lot of people don't. They stay on those sort of king of SAT prep roads. What caused you to change it?
Well, I have a good friend of mine named Adam Smith. He was one of my fraternity brothers.
Right.
And they did this thing called Y Combinator back in 2006. And it was really kind of isolating for me because I was working on my startup, but I didn't really have other friends that were doing that. And so here for the first time was a really good friend of mine also starting a company. And I actually rented out space in their living room. It's this thing, it's because they got started out of an apartment in Cambridge and, instead of like couches and TVs in the living room, it was like a bunch of folding tables and like nine LCD monitors and Aeron chairs. And so watching them go through that experience, they're just, and how much fun they were having, how much progress they were making, they made, and then Adam moved out of Boston and went and moved to San Francisco. This is from Zobni. The company's called Zobni. And then was raised millions of dollars and was talking to all these, you know, like people that I had only read about. And then they were handing him, you know, just wheelbarrows full of cash to go build his company.
That's how they do it in Silicon Valley, by the way. Wheelbarrows.
Yeah. And I was like, holy shit, like I gotta get out there.
I gotta get me some,
yeah.
Essentially. But so why not Boston? Why couldn't you stay in Boston?
Well, I think, and people wring their hands about this a lot, but...
In Boston, you know, they do.
In Boston, yeah. You know, I think there really is a dynamic. I mean, you can start a company anywhere, and great companies have been started, you know, all over the world. But for consumer internet anyway, you know... consumer internet or tech is to the Valley in the same way that, you know, if you're in entertainment, you know, you go to LA, or if you're in, you know, in finance, you go to New York. And it's not to say you can't do these things elsewhere, but the ecosystem there is unlike anywhere else. And, you know, you can only work on one thing at a time in general. And so you want, if this is your baby, you want to maximize the chances for success. And I felt that all my friends who moved out to San Francisco from Boston or wherever else, we're just making so much more progress and sort of getting plugged in at such a faster rate than I had been kind of bootstrapping.
Interestingly ironic that you're doing a virtual cloud company and you have to be somewhere physical kind of thing. So you move out to do the... was there any regret from doing that, from not staying in the MIT area?
Well,
because, you know, Silicon Valley is a little dominated by Stanford people, not MIT people, which is why you're a pleasure, but go ahead.
You know, so I had
comparatively.
I had grown up in Boston, and I had gone to school in Boston. And I was there for a year or two after graduation, and you know, I just remember this day where, you know, I love it in Boston, but I do remember this day where I was like parking my car and like, you know, scraping ice off of it, and almost slipped and like cracked my face, and you know, I'm just walking down, sort of trudging down into work, and the wind is like blowing sideways, and I'm like wearing like a t-shirt, and I'm just like.
And there was no wheelbarrow full of money anywhere. It would have blown away.
Yeah. So it was also like just a personal decision to try a new place. And you know, all my friends who had done that had a really great time.
So you're out here and you come out to, you go to Y Combinator immediately.
Yeah.
Because that's the mecca.
Well, we actually did Y Combinator in Boston.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Over that summer. So we started in, you know, April 2007.
Right, and got some money from them.
And then we got our first, investment from Y Combinator.
Which was $15,000?
$15,000.
And you, then you came out, and Paul insisted, Paul Graham, who runs Y Combinator, insisted you have an arranged marriage, essentially. How did you feel about that?
The backstory on that is I started working on Dropbox myself. Because it was just, you know, something that I personally wanted, you know, even if it weren't like a business. And then I'd come out to California, or I'd come out to the Valley a couple times to just hang out with other Y Combinator, or to hang out with Y Combinator founders, tried to pitch Paul on the idea. You know, one of the things he said was like, we're not going to fund you unless you have a co-founder.
Really? And what was his reason for that?
Because they had found that, they tried that. They had funded single founders before, but they just felt that companies that had teams just really outperformed ones that just had one founder. Or it's just much easier to kind of give up or kind of get discouraged as a single founder.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you find this marriage of yours?
So it was pretty rough. So, you know, this was like 2 weeks before the application deadline. And so it is like asking someone to get married in 2 weeks, you know, and so you're kind of starting from scratch. And for various reasons, the other friends I knew from school, just were not ready to make a jump into doing a startup like this. And it turned out the same kind of cabin fever that I was getting from, you know, watching Adam move to San Francisco and all his friends and our mutual friends like suddenly really getting their companies off the ground. It turned out there was another guy named Kyle Vogt who started a company called Justin TV, who actually dropped out of MIT and did the same kind of pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. And he had a friend named Arash who you know, watches Kyle drop out and, you know, their company starts taking off. So Kyle's building all this cool technology. Justin from Justin TV is like going on the Today Show, and this everything's kind of blowing up at the same time. And he's like, when you have that going on, you're like, okay, the hell with the rest of these like problem sets. Like, I need to get out there. And Kyle had heard me complaining that I didn't have a co-founder, and so Arash had also seen a little video that I made, sort of demonstrating Dropbox, and we just got introduced over email, and like hung out in the student center for a couple hours, and we're like, yeah, of course we're gonna. And then he decided to do it, and he, you know, drops out of school.
After a latte, he decided this?
Yeah, it was like maybe two. I don't know if he drinks coffee. I don't think he drinks coffee.
So he's easy, and so are you, but yeah. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, of course. We've spent 2 hours together, and of course we're going to spend all of our waking hours for the foreseeable future together.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, every startup needs their lucky breaks, for sure.
What was it about him that you liked?
It was clear that he was really smart, and it was clear that he was interested in a lot of the same things that I was from a technical standpoint, just what, and the idea of starting a company. But at the same time, so there's, areas where we're both, like, pretty technically strong and very focused on product. And we're also kind of complementary. So I'm interested in, what's exciting about me, to me about starting a company, and why I didn't want to just stay in engineering is because there was this, I discovered in college that there's just this whole other world of stuff beyond just the engineering,
right?
That really matters. And Arash is much more focused on making sure, he wants to make sure the product is great. And one thing about him that I totally didn't, anticipate or didn't identify early on was just he has a really good intuition on people and culture, which is like very unusual. It just worked out, and we've worked really well together since.
You started to get your first funding, and the first real funding you got was from the rug guy in Palo Alto, which is a famous guy who, he sells rugs, but he also invests in internet companies, and he trades rugs for internet companies and things like that. It's Pejman Nozad?
Pejman, yeah.
Pejman Nozad, who you recently, in a Forbes article, called your pimp, which was a lovely way to look upon the man who gave you your first funding. But he got you, he did, in fact, introduce you sort of in a Persian rug version of Sean Parker to Sequoia, correct?
That's right.
It's funny. So the rug guy got you going.
Yeah, so the first lesson
was... Did you get
a
rug, by the way?
We haven't gotten... We're still waiting for the rug.
Okay,
that's coming.
Right.
The first lesson from that was don't ever use the word pimp in front of a reporter.
Mm-hmm. Which you just did again. Go ahead.
So there's this guy, Pejman, who came to Y Combinator's demo day, and that's one of the great things about Y Combinator is they set you up all these investors, which makes your life a lot easier when you go raise money. And he came running up to Arash, actually, who is also Iranian or of Iranian descent. And at the time, we were lining up this other angel round and thought we were pretty far along, and we're like, oh, we don't have time to talk to more angel investors. Like, this stuff looks pretty good, and we're probably set. But he twisted our arm and convinced us to come down to the Medallion Rug Store on University Ave, and we take our zip car down and we show up and we go into this rug store and we're like, it's empty. There's rugs everywhere, but there's not very many people.
Yeah, they sell rugs. It usually doesn't have any but rugs. But go ahead.
We ask for Pejman, and he takes us into this secret boardroom and serves us Persian tea and stuff. And,
okay.
And then he introduced.
And you said this guy is the one we want the money from. Why did you say this guy?
It's just unconventional, right? It's not exactly your typical Sand Hill Road experience.
No.
To be entering into
usually khakis and a Starbucks, but go ahead.
Yeah, we're entering secret passageways, and he was really enthusiastic and really helpful, and offered to set us up with all these different people. And one of the people he proposed was we should talk to some of the folks at Sequoia. And we're like, we thought this, our other financing was all set, and it's too early for us. And so the idea of approaching Sequoia was pretty intimidating, just because we were just we'd literally not unpacked our boxes in our living room and just set foot, and our business was not really ready yet. But in Pejman fashion, he convinced us to do it, and we're like, fine, well, we can start, building a relationship with Sequoia. And he came with us, and we did our first pitch, and I think he also, afterwards, whispered in, Samir, our partner, or the partner, Sequoia partner, who we talked to. He's like, these guys are going to go, they have all these offers, you got to act today,
So we
had other offers, but the maybe not as forcefully as he...
Well, he sells rugs, and he's probably good at it. So he sold your rug to Sequoia. You got $1.2 million at that point. What did you think about when you were taking that money? What was the decision making about? Because a lot of entrepreneurs wonder how much they should take.
Well, for us, we were shocked that they even were paying attention, because we thought we were much earlier stage, and we were just grateful to have serious interest from them. Because we'd seen, a couple of our, peers had gone on to raise money from Sequoia, and they, their companies did really well. And so we were just thrilled to have that opportunity, and they really understood what we were doing. And, it was a surreal experience. You'd go in there our first meeting was on a Friday. And then, so we talked to Samir, and Pejman was there too. And then Samir calls me up at 10 at night, and he's like, "Hey, Mike wants to come by tomorrow morning because he can't
Mike
make
Moritz.
The market." And yeah, I'm like, "Mike," and he's like, "Yeah, Mike Moritz." And he's like, "Is it cool if we come by tomorrow morning?" And I'm like, "Okay, well, there's only one answer to that question." And I'm like, "Yeah."
You should have said no. That won't work for me. You didn't, but that's okay.
Yeah, so I'm like, "Oh, he has all these coffee shops around North Beach where we were staying," or sort of jokingly, I was like, "Oh, or you can come to Dropbox World HQ." And it was our apartment building is totally trashed. And he's like, "That's great. That sounds great. We'll see you at 10. And so we're furiously cleaning up the apartment, and sure enough, Mike shows up. My only regret is I didn't get to see hovercraft he must have ridden over or whatever. But he showed up, and he's chilling on our couch, and I'm going through all the presentation, and he asked a couple questions about competition, but then gave us the green light, and then
so you got the money right away. You're surprised. That's interesting. Well, you're surprised because there's not enough rat holes to shove the money down that these VCs have in Silicon Valley. I don't know if you're aware of that, but
yeah, I mean we sort of, this was all a new experience for us. Show up on Friday, Mike Moritz is in your apartment on Saturday morning. Then we have a partners meeting on Monday. Go out to dinner that night and have a handshake deal. And suddenly, there are very few experiences for a 24-year-old that resemble Christmas as much as logging into your Bank of America checking account, which had $60 in it, and just keep hitting refresh every morning until the wire transfer went through.
Then you bought
Porsche.
It's
$1.2 million.
Yeah. What did you do? What did you buy? It's the first thing.
I think we bought an IKEA desk,
Fantastic. Nice. Yeah. The Schnono. They always have those names at IKEA that you don't understand where they came up from. All right, so let's talk about the product. So you're starting to build a product.
Yeah.
We're going to get to the harder stuff in a minute. Just want to get you ready.
All right.
And then we'll have questions from the audience, by the way, because you all have better questions than I ever could have. So you wanted one thing, a service that worked for all kinds of operating systems. You wanted it to work across a lot of devices. This is pre a lot of these explosion of devices, because this was early on, the 2008 period was not, tablets.
Yeah.
But it just was starting. It was just beginning. It had to work over operating systems. It had to work for tweaking for various changes and stuff like that. You did all sorts of odd things, like giving away storage in order to get referrals. It was costing a lot to do it.
Yeah.
Talk about sort of the one good thing, what we were thinking of at the time, and then the one good decision you made, and maybe a few of the bad ones.
Yeah. Well, I think from a product standpoint, what I wanted was sort of the simplest thing that could possibly work. And to me, that was just this idea of this magic folder, where anything you save into that folder saves everywhere, and then we take care of it for you. And so, and it's funny, because we get all these questions now, or over the years we've gotten these questions of why did you choose one folder? Why don't you let me synchronize all these other folders?
Yeah, Walt Mossberg has a question about that. I'll ask him then.
And we found the benefits of just making it really simple.
It's simple.
Completely outweighed any of the other concerns. We built something simple because we didn't have time to build something complicated. But then we found that there are a lot of advantages to that over time.
Being the most simple rather than the more.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing.
There were several where I copied your desktop. There were several where there were.
Yeah, well, they sort of, a bunch of these other programs just kind of in the sort of install experience, they start introducing all these concepts that are very confusing. Map all these different folders to different places. And we actually, one kind of pivotal moment for a lot of the early team was we brought in people, five people off of Craigslist. like literally off the street. And we sat them down in front of Dropbox, and it was just like
Did you use friends seeking friends?
What's that?
Did you use? They thought you wanted to pee on them, but go ahead. San Francisco.
We're like, sorry to disappoint you guys.
It's San Francisco, and it's okay. Okay.
We definitely had some funky people come in the door that day.
See.
We set them down in front of a computer, and we're like, hey, here's this thing called Dropbox. You know, go from Dropbox, you know, this email invitation or Dropbox.com and, like, you know, share a file with this person. And it was just a total train wreck. I mean, you know, we set up a computer in the other room, and we were sort of live, like, streaming it to our conference room where we brought the entire team in for a whole afternoon. We had a bunch of music equipment, and so we have, like, this microphone that's sort of, you know, streaming into the room, too. And so we could see in real time just, like, this horrific situation where people just could not understand at all, like, how this works or how to get started with it or what it does. You know, people clicking the screenshots in the tour and people not figuring out how to, you know, the download window of the browser getting obscured, and then they never figure out how to install it. I mean, just that we made this list of, like, 80 things. That really confused people, and you know, if the person can't figure out how to, like, start the installer, you know, they're not going to figure out this complex, like, this crazy, like, folder mapping structure. And so, more and more, that's just given us a new perspective on, like, what something simple actually is, and how to design products for, like, normal people.
Normal people again.
Yeah.
The people who were designing these were not normal, in that they created things that were easy to use if you had a PhD.
Yeah. Exactly.
So how is that done? Because it's very hard to do that. It's like, how do you keep doing that?
Well, I think first you need to understand how real people, you know, or normal people, like, behave.
Right.
It's funny because, like, I mean, I think the hallmark of, like, a good product is that there's a high probability that you show up at, like, the homepage and end up with, like, a solved problem. And it's not just, like, visual design or other things. You know, it takes something like Craigslist, right? You show up at Craigslist, and chances are, yeah, the design gets, you know, ridiculed for being, like, out of, you know, a relic from the 90s. But chances are you leave with your concert tickets or your
whatever.
Friends looking for friends or whatever you want.
Whatever.
So
put that in the whatever.
But it works.
Right.
And so, you know, that was really kind of how we thought about. So what we think about now is, like, okay, what problems do people have with their technology? And, like, the world's become a lot more complicated for people since 2007 when we started. Like, when we started, there was no iPhone or iPad, or, you know, people weren't taking pictures with their phones or, you know.
Uploading videos.
Yeah. And so it turns out that, ideally, technology should serve you, you know, not the other way around. And
ideally.
And it should make your life simpler, not more complicated. But we're finding that there's all these new problems that people have. And I think another interesting aspect about our business is there's no, like, market for what we were making. You know, no one was searching for it. We did some experiments with, like, trying to buy AdWords, and the problem was people were doing just fine, like, with emailing themselves stuff and, you know, carrying around their thumb drives, and no one was, like, waking up in the middle of the night being like, oh my God, like, why do I have to do this? You know, you sort of scrape by, and it's like, okay, and you don't think about it. So if you don't know that you have a problem, you're not going to be searching for a solution. And so that opens up a lot of opportunity, is when you can find a way to solve a problem that people don't even know they have, and then it actually works. Like, that's a pretty good day for most users.
So you started to do this, and you did take off more than others. It's just an interesting, and I think it has to do with this theories around delightful, easy to use, delightful, and stuff like that. The idea that it's like an Instagram, very easy and simple, and you get it dead. So the person most responsible for this, in general, most people, Steve Jobs, called you, wanting to buy you because you were doing what he did very well over and over again. Talk a little bit about that meeting and why you turned him down. He offered $100 million, reportedly, is that correct?
We actually didn't get to numbers. People speculated about different, you know, dollar figures.
Just making that up?
They just made it up,
okay. All right, so nonetheless, you have this meeting with Steve Jobs, mm-hmm. another probably great thing for someone who's young like you to meet. Why did you want to turn him down? And then he ended up insulting you, which was nice. Classy.
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing we show another Zipcar ride down to Cupertino.
Okay.
And, you know, we show up at the front desk or One Infinite Loop or whatever, and we're like, it's like, what do you say to the receptionist? We're like, well, we're here to see Steve. It's like, right. But like, you know, we sit down and we're like, oh man, like maybe he hasn't seen the product, doesn't know what we actually do, so we should probably get a demo together. And so, you know, we have this ritual of like getting our demo account set up and everything, and Arash and I are furiously trying to do that.
He's not going to do that.
Well, so what's that?
He's not going to do that. I can just tell you that already. And he didn't.
And so, well, so we go up to, so we go up into the boardroom, and you know, he comes in and sits down and sort of stares off and, you know, sort of gently rocking back and forth, and he's like, you know, where do we begin? And he said, you know, he thinks we have a great product, which was, you know, high praise coming from him. And, you know, he's like, hey, you should really think about throwing in with us because you'll reach a lot more people and all these other reasons. Apple's like a giant startup and all these things. And, you know, we'd made it, like, really clear to everybody we had talked to along the way that, like, the company's not for sale. Like, we're really having a great experience building this. But, you know, they want us to talk to Steve anyway. So, you know, I was really flattered. Obviously, you know, we're huge fans of Apple. But, you know, we really want to build this company, and it's been this great experience, and, you know, it's a unique kind of thing to do with your life. And the challenge there is, I talked to other friends of mine who had like, encounters with Steve, and you either get, like, chill Steve or asshole Steve. And so I was just kind of like, okay, well, I said that, and I'm like, you know, like sucking my breath, and I'm like waiting for like chairs to get thrown or something, or you know. But he was totally cool. I mean, he started trolling us a little bit. He's like, you know, you guys are a feature, not a product, and right. You know, you'll never have like deep access to the underlying, you know, operating system on these phones. But you know, the same thing is true of you know, Google trying to build on iOS also. So, kind of agree to disagree, and the formal part of the meeting was over pretty quickly. But then. It was a cool like conversation.
It was chill, and yet he knifed through the heart. You're just a feature.
You know, I think I don't know.
That's called a knife to the heart. But.
Well, I think he's just you know trying to rile us up a little bit. But right. But anyway, he talked about coming back to you know Apple after you know being gone and the Valley and you know and our investors and all kinds of stuff. So it was cool.
So same thing with Google. What happened with them?
Those were much like every startup that like gets any kind of traction like has these inquiries from different startups, and it is a similar kind of thing. Either their corporate development people reached out, and you know we just let them know that we weren't interested in selling the company, and then they're like, okay.
So you didn't get insulted by Larry?
No.
Or someone. Okay.
No.
All right. Well, I'm sure he'll do that in the future. He likes to do that. So you later iCloud came up, but then you grow. You go to what 50 million users now. $240 million in revenue, is that correct?
That's from the
correct?
Forbes article.
But is it correct?
We have never talked about our revenue.
But could you write now? Just tell me. No?
Tell you later.
No, I don't want to know later. I know now. Right here.
Yeah.
Is it in the range?
I can't say.
Wink.
Should I like wiggle my fingers?
Wiggle
something?
Your fingers.
All right.
Oh, he's not wiggling. Interesting. $4 billion valuation?
That's right.
That's correct.
That's
okay.
Correct.
So the silly number is correct. Okay, good. So profitable?
We're profitable.
Profitable. Very profitable?
Profitable.
Okay, but that could be like a dollar. Okay, all right. Now, 96% of people don't pay for your service. The ones that do pay more for $10 for the 50 gigs. What most of those people are using more than that?
So are paying users using?
Yeah.
The paying users obviously tend to use more space than they would in the free.
Right. Okay. But are more people moving to that?
Yeah.
As they're getting more stuff, you're getting more paid.
Yes.
So that number is going to drop the 96%.
Yes. I mean, it's basically what happens is people join Dropbox and they figure out how to use it over time. And so that they, you know, after you get more and more stuff in there, you tend to pay.
Okay. So let's get to the difficult parts. Here you are.
Okay.
You've built this company. You've withstood the attacks of chilling Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
You didn't sell. You're growing into a thing. You got another giant round of ridiculous funding. This time, 200 and how much money did you get?
$250 million.
$250 million, which is better than
$1.2 million.
Yes. What'd you buy? An IKEA
more
desk.
IKEA desk.
IKEA desk was fantastic. The one that was bigger. Many
people. We got
people,
the silver leg one.
The silver, right,
the black
very
leg.
Nice. Nice. Again, keeping it classy over at Dropbox. But since then, you've been undergone kind of a lot of like criticism of where it's going. Like this is when it comes out. Security issues, copyright issues, a big issue. other competitors, including Apple, Google, Amazon, and a lot of the smaller ones who are getting big, Boxnet.
Yep.
There's lots of little ones. I just saw one, Space Monkey. Gobbler. There's all kinds of things that are building storage devices, people calling it a commodity, a feature, things like that. Which one of these would you like to address first?
Well, we can talk about the competition.
Sure.
Well, I think one thing people forget is we've always been in this like environment of like crazy competition, you know, and maybe the cast of characters changes and people will focus like more intensely on our space. But we've always been in that kind of environment where there's all kinds of people doing things that are related to what we do, or there's overlap, big companies, little companies, and so on. And so, you know, I think as far as the commodity piece, I think another important thing we think about is, you know, when someone buys Dropbox, they're not like, oh, thank God I have this much, you know, this many gigabytes of storage for this many, you know, pennies per gigabyte per month. It's really like Dropbox is this experience that like frees me to have, that sort of takes care of all my stuff, and I'm free to use it wherever. And that experience, like getting the engineering right on that experience is really difficult, and I think that's still, if you ask people why they use Dropbox instead of, you know, there's all kinds of other services out there that give you a lot more free space, but, our users find that it's just not as easy to use, or sometimes, you know, in the forums, we'll see people who say, you know, screw you guys, I'm going to, you know, this other company that gives us like 10 times as much free storage. And, you know, often a few weeks later they come back and they're like, oh, never mind, the thing like destroyed all my stuff.
So it's the experience, the engineering, the simplicity.
Yeah.
So you think you can win. I mean, getting from whatever revenue you have to the billions of dollars that you'll need to have to support the kind of valuations you're having, how do you do that then in this space when there are Apple's coming with iCloud eventually, sometime, who knows. Google's coming in with their Drive or whatever they're doing. Amazon is obviously sort of the, not a dark horse, but some very formidable and already in the area.
Yeah.
How do you get to the next level? Because that's really where it's hard. That's the.
Well, so there's a couple things. The first is the market is just like insane, right? This is Dropbox is the kind of thing that is useful to pretty much anyone with a computer or a phone. And that's like 2 billion people. And so even, and that'll be like 5 billion, you know, over the next 10 years or so. And so, you know, even with a number like 50 million, that's only a couple percent of the people will eventually reach. And so I think people don't realize how kind of early this is. The second thing is we're kind of uniquely situated in terms of, you know, we provide a really good experience across every major platform. And I think historically, what you see with things, you know, even like iCloud, is it works really great if you have, you know, a Mac and an Apple TV and an iPhone and iPad. But there's no like Android version of iCloud, nor is it likely ever to be. And you know, Apple might be a little more, that might be kind of more of something that they're a little more religious about. But we found that, you know, all of these guys have their own kind of home base and their turf to protect, and you know they're not very keen on putting their best engineers. You know, if you're at Google, you know, building a great like a wonderful iOS experience, like why would you put your best engineers on that when you could put them on making a good Android experience and giving people reasons to buy Android phones? And so I think that kind of incentive has made it challenging to go to the kind of crazy lengths that we do to make the experience really good.
And do you have, you're talking about engineering prowess,
yeah,
that you have the better engineers working on this. Do you need to be in the guts of these systems? Because there's now really two sort of coalescing around Android and Apple at this point. RIM is doing whatever it's doing. There's others. Windows is trying very hard to get in there. But for the most part, these two companies do control a great deal of it. Do you need to, what Jobs was saying to you?
Well, I think a big part of the engineering challenge is first of all, you know, and like why now or why us? I mean, we're not the first or 10th or like 100th people to have this idea. And if it were easy to build, like someone would have already done a good job. And you know, I think one of the things that
is that the if you had invented Facebook, you'd have invented Facebook answer.
Well, I think, you know, if people, you know, it's kind of like it's kind of like search, right? Anybody can make a text box that returns links to other web pages, right? But obviously when you hit search on Google or anywhere else, like all kinds of crazy things happen under the hood. And there's just years and years of kind of institutional knowledge that you build about how to solve that problem better than anyone. And The same thing is true when you put something in, you know, save a photo in your Dropbox or drop something in. And, you know, just there's this, all this engineering that has gone on to, like, first, like, really connect deeply into the operating system. And second is really just the scale of the infrastructure. So, you know, people save a billion files on Dropbox every couple of days. And that's, like, way more than there are tweets on Twitter. Right, and these are not just like 140 character snippets, but this is like your tax return and your, you know, your most important stuff. And doing that flawlessly at scale is a hard problem. And there's you know, the other companies might solve that piece of it too.
So engineering prevails the way you do this. That's your answer. That, speaking of saving copyright, Hollywood has done a lot of damage to a lot of companies and continues to rail against a lot of things that are going on with, whether it's YouTube or whatever is going on. How big a threat is that to you right now? What people are saving there?
We were concerned about our users doing that kind of thing early on, but it's turned out to be like much rarer than we thought. And, you know, this is something that any internet service at scale confronts. But you know, if anything nowadays, like we get all this inbound interest from labels or managers or artists being like, hey, this is, you guys have like an audience of 50 million people. You could be an amazing channel to like promote things or another relationship where they and where sharing might actually be like really useful for them. And so, you know, we don't think copyright issues, the DMCA sets out exactly what you're supposed to do. And we followed that, you know, since.
And yet, what was going on with the crazy dude in Australia? I mean, how do you react to that? You don't behave like that, do you?
I don't have machine guns, like assault rifles in my backyard.
Okay.
Or a compound, but
next
someday. It's really all about just the proportion. I don't really know what the situation there was, but you know, if you're like become, if it's like a prevalent activity where people are, you know, sharing copyrighted things, then, you know, you need, then that's a problem.
And how do you combat it? How do you know you're doing the right thing there?
Well, so there's things like the DMCA establishes, okay, well, here's the relationship you need to have with the rights holders. And, you know, we give, to the extent that there is any, this kind of thing happens, we, you know, the people have tools to take stuff down. And there's other, you know, thing, boxes you have to check as far as being compliant with it. But, you know, you do that and it's fine.
Okay. So you're not worried about copyright? You're not too worried about competitors? Security. How worried are you about what happened with your password thing? A small incursion, but nonetheless,
yeah.
Security is probably your number one issue if people are putting their tax returns or whatever the hell they're putting up there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that is like our promise to people is that, you know, for tens of millions of people, we're going to take care of your most important stuff and we're going to protect it from all kinds, all the bad things that could conceivably happen to it. And so not just security or, you know, people breaking in or different things, but like, you know, making sure that the, you know, that we never lose data and that it's reliable and that the servers are always up and even just other things like making sure it's fast. And so there are things like that, that have always been really important to us. And so, I mean, we have more experience like solving this problem at scale than just about anybody else.
Are you vulnerable? Do you feel you're kind of being smaller? You have 110 people working for you. You have all these billions of files. Are you more vulnerable? And Google has SWAT teams that go out to fix things and do other things. I don't know what they do, but
I don't particularly think so. I mean, you know, we've done like a lot of stuff with a very small team. It's like we're pretty proud of that. And you know, all these teams will grow, and we'll have, of course, we'll invest a ton more in all those areas as we get bigger.
What are you most worried about? Those are the challenges facing you. So,
I mean, the two things that I really care about are one, you know, making sure that we build the right things and that we make our users really happy, and two is getting the very best people into the company. And if you do those two things, you can screw up just about anything else. But if you don't do those two things, then you know that. Done. And so, you know, it's easy to kind of from the outside look at competition or other things and be like, wow, you know, these guys have such, this is like a tough situation. But you know, more often than not, you know, companies that make it far along but then somehow die, that happens because like self-inflicted wounds. Meaning, you know, you make the product too complicated or confusing, or you have all these people running around building, jamming all these new features into it and making it hard to use. Or, you know, you try to grow too fast, and, you know, you don't organize the company properly, or you're not as thoughtful about, you know, hiring only really, really good people. And so it's those are the two things I spend the most time
on. Nobody's going to shoot you. You're going to shoot yourself.
Yes,
if you do,
I'm pretty convinced.
With the machine gun you have in the backyard,
right.
Presumably. Last question, and then we'll get to some questions from the audience. Third party developing on Dropbox? People are very interested in that idea.
Yeah.
Like, where is that right now? Because that seems critical to you. And why would they do it for you versus the big ones where they could get more audience?
It's a really cool time for us, actually, where, you know, I think people know us today as like this app that you put on your computer or your phone. But they don't realize to what extent that we're just scratching the surface of all the amazing things that we can do. Because what's really interesting about these last 4 or 5 years is like just all these new things in your life that need to be tied together. And all these new problems that you have. Like, well, okay, you know, my mom has her music in iTunes, but then she wants to listen to it on her Android phone and that doesn't work. The world needs this really, you know, large scale and elegant solution to tie everything together, because there's all this fragmentation and all these new things that don't talk to each other. And so more and more, instead of just being an app on your phone or computer, we're going to make all this other stuff that you use better. And there's all these opportunities, you know, as we go from millions of users to tens of millions of users to hundreds of millions of users, to make all these other experiences, make your TV better, or make your phone better, or make your tablet better. And what we're finding is that we have all these developers find that it's a much easier, better experience for the user to store their information in Dropbox and kind of plug into that. And if you think about it, it's kind of like Facebook, where everybody's kind of established their friend relationships on Facebook and their social graph and everything. And Facebook's contribution is not only using Facebook.com, but then all these other services that can become better because they plug into your social graph, and so you don't have to like redefine your friend and follow relationships over and over again. And the same thing is true for getting to your stuff, right? It's an elemental kind of building block of the internet. It's, some service like ours is going to tie all of this together, and it's any app, any services, any device that needs to create or consume content, could plug into something like Dropbox, and does more and more.
Truly believe. I mean, you're talking about being Switzerland in what's a global mobile world war between major players.
Yeah,
you can do that.
I mean, we think that's one way to look at it. I mean, we think of the world more just like, what kinds of things are broken that we can make much better. And there are a lot of examples, right? I just moved into a new apartment, and like I got a new TV and receiver and AV stuff, and it's really exciting because like now there's a, my TV has a Wi-Fi chipset and like everything's connected, but the total experience is like pretty bad. It's like I feel like I've now like 10 ways to watch Netflix badly, because
okay.
All the remotes have like 90
buttons.
There's
nothing
on it
anyway, because
there's an example. It's an interesting time because like until very recently there was no phone or tablet or TV or remote control that has a button on it that's like get to your stuff. And if you think about it, it's a lot like email or maps was in the early days on your phone, where it's like everybody remembers kind of the first day of the rest of your life where it's like, oh my God, I can be waiting in these half hour lines and actually get that time back because I can be productive, or I never have to like pull over the side of the road to ask for directions. And that expectation just changes overnight. And we think the same thing is true of getting to your stuff. It's just a very fundamental need for anything that you use. And so we have all this opportunity, both with our core product, but then also making all these the platform and enabling app developers and some of our partners on the device manufacturing side to make all those experiences a lot better.
Very last question. You're calling yourself sort of a Facebook kind of, you're comparing yourself a little bit to Facebook there, and that idea. You met with Zuckerberg. Did he insult you or give you advice? Which one?
he didn't insult us. He's been great. He's given us advice.
And chance.
Just stuff around scaling the company and how to. It's just a variety of different things, but it's been a great relationship. There's a lot of interesting stuff we could potentially do together.
Okay, questions from the audience. There's the mics. They're up here. I think we just got a few minutes, so keep the question. Oh, there's lots of questions. We can probably go a little longer.
All right.
So this talk had a network effect in the title. I'm just curious, do you think there's any solid network effect within Dropbox that really insulates you from competition?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one thing that's interesting about Dropbox is it's like potentially useful for all these dozens of different things. And what happens is maybe you start using it because you heard, okay, it's a way that I can like back up my photos. But then, you know, you start using it at work because there's a project that you're collaborating on. And then, you know, your contractor who's remodeling your house shares the plans with you on Dropbox. And then, you know, and then you share this stuff with your family and this stuff with your college friends. You know, that those kinds of things, those sharing relationships are kind of classic network effects.
And meaning if someone's in an Android world and an Apple world, they can do that if they're not.
I'm just talking about the sort of person-to-person sharing relationships. But absolutely, you know, the platform coverage and supporting those, making the best possible experience everywhere is something that I think, you know, we're
that insulates
well-suited.
You. That insulates you from possibility.
Yeah, and you know, when your phone is like works natively with Dropbox, then using something else means like your phone doesn't work anymore. You know, and so that's another important thing we think about.
Of course, you'd be screwed if Apple and Google merged. But go ahead.
Hi, I'm working in Central America quite a bit, and Dropbox is one of those platforms, a newer platform that I'm seeing used quite a bit in places like Guatemala and Costa Rica, and that's it's pretty rare to see something like that come through, and so I wanted to commend you on that. And then my question is really, is there going to be like a multilingual version of Dropbox that's going to come out? Second is, are there going to be features that are going to be specific to that audience?
So it's been really cool to see Dropbox kind of spread all over the world. So we have like, you know, since very early, like 2/3 of our users are outside the U.S. You know, we've got paying users in 175 countries. We hear all these kind of crazy stories about how it's being used. And we actually do have Dropbox in a few other languages, and there will be more over time. And, you know, usually the country-specific stuff revolves around payments or, you know, or other kind of local challenges like that.
Hi, Drew. Privacy, mostly from an ethical and a legal point of view, how do you deal with the U.S. or Chinese or Syrian government asking you access?
They're different everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're under the U.S. jurisdiction, so we focus mainly on that. And that's another thing where they, you know, every kind of internet consumer service at scale has to set out, okay, well, what happens when you get a subpoena? Or what happens when there are these different requests from different government agencies? And sort of our philosophical stance is to, you know, this is one of the most important transitions of this decade is, you know, when your sort of hard drive or your stuff goes from being on a, you know, in a laptop to being, you know, on servers like ours. And so one thing that I'm really proud of is actually if you look at our privacy policy and our terms of service, it's written in plain English. Like we actually, the word like your stuff is like the legal term that we use, and we describe exactly what happens. You know, what happens when we, you know, get a subpoena and that we push back, and you know we really want to be the best possible advocate.
How many subpoenas have you had over the years?
It's been pretty rare. I mean, it's, you know, maybe a couple dozen.
How many have you fought?
We look into all of them. We don't talk about anything specific.
Have you given up people's information?
I mean, in very, like, you know, count on one hand kind of things that have all been legitimate.
We have time for one more question.
All right, guys.
Hello. I would like to come back to your co-founder thing. So when you are working for 1 year or 2 years on a product, then you have the idea, you craft the business model, and then an investor ask you to find a co-founder, what type of equity are you giving to him?
Well, so I'm not going to talk about the specifics of our situation, but, you know, he joined, even though I had the, you know, as I said, started working on it, you know, there's a lot of different resources that people can look at as far as how to divide up co-founder equity, and so we did a pretty typical thing.
Okay, in other words.
Yeah.
Last question, Drew, we've got 36 seconds. Who do you admire? And what do you think is overhyped? Two answers quickly. 31 seconds.
I certainly admire all the sort of, you know, the last and this generation of people who have, you know, especially founder CEOs who have built these amazing companies. So Apple, Google, Facebook, you know, the list goes on. I think Jeff Bezos is pretty amazing in terms of his ability to think long term and make some pretty wild bets. Andy Grove, who is one of the sort of founding engineers at Intel, and started as an engineer, rose up to CEO, and I think he's just an amazing thinker on management. So it's really folks like that.
Anything overhyped right now?
It's kind of you never know with some of these things. These things may start out overhyped and then turn out to be really amazing. So I worry. You know, one of the things that was important to me is having a working business model from the beginning, and you know, sometimes those things work. You know, it's actually harder to get a big audience and a lot of engagement, but I think it'll be interesting to watch some of these companies that are now just experimenting with ads or monetization that have reached huge numbers of users. You know, like the Twitter and Instagram, Foursquare, folks like that.
Yeah, they make money.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much.
Great.